Hi, podcast audience. We've kicked off our May Day to Memorial Day membership drive. Want to know more? Well, our goal is to increase our patrons by just 25 more before the end of May. If you love our show, will you help us? If you're already a member, spread the word and ask a friend to join you in membership. And if you're a first-time listener, become part of our patron community. Patrons receive extra content, behind-the-scenes research, and more. Become a patron today for as little as $3 a month at patreon.com/The LF Show. That's patreon.com/The LF Show. Hi, I'm Laura Flanders, and this is The Laura Flanders Show, the TV and radio program that seeks to raise radical spirits by interviewing forward-thinking people with real-life models of shifting power from the few to the many in the worlds of arts, entrepreneurship, and governance. This week, two artists expand our ideas about beauty, risk, mobility, and inclusion. Wheelchair dancer and esteemed choreographer Alice Shepherd and MacArthur Genius Award winner, action architect, Elizabeth Streb. What difference does art make? Should art making be a human right? What will it take to disable the limits society puts around the normal? These questions and more this week on The Laura Flanders Show, the place where the people who say it can't be done take a back seat to the people who are doing it. Welcome. German playwright Bertolt Brecht once famously remarked that the artist's job is not to reflect reality, but to change it. Our next guest is doing just that in stunning ways, blowing open old ideas about bodies and beauty and movement and motion with her visceral performances that feature light, dance, and technology, including wheelchair technology and crutches. Her name is Alice Shepherd, formerly a medieval studies professor. She's now a choreographer, dancer, and the founder of Kinetic Light, an artistic collaboration with dancer, technologist Laurel Lawson, and lighting and video artist Michael Magg. Alice, welcome. If you had to sum up, and I'm not going to ask you to do in a word, but your passion, what is your passion at this moment in your art?
I am actually enjoying the physical experience of it. There's a moment of actual togetherness that I seek, that I experience, and I want to share with you. It's an incredible feeling, and that finding that, being in that, is what I'm looking for right now.
Well, you shared the joy with a lot of us in New York not so long ago when you performed at New York Live Arts a piece called Descent, a show called Descent, and Kinetic Light put on this extraordinary experience, ostensibly a queer interracial love story based on classic mythology.
Yep.
But a whole lot more than that. I mean, never has Velcro strapping sounded so sexy.
Yes!
Do you want to describe it a little?
Right. So a lot of the time, as wheelchair users, we use straps to secure ourselves into the chair. And some of that's a daily practice for some people. Sometimes people say, are you strapping yourself to the chair? Or are you strapping you to the chair to you? Both. To be able to complete the kinds of movement we do where we invert and we roll and the slide. But there's also a moment where strapping is political for us. And in Descent, it becomes about sexuality and that moment of if you unstrap the seat belt. And, you know, it's equivalent to undressing. So who unstraps who and how? And the sort of extended noise as the Velcro unfurls and the softness in that moment. Yeah. So we wanted to be able to do that and really to be able to invite people into the world of disability and into disability culture and into the kind of things that you don't necessarily know if you're not disabled. But I'm also going to say, most important, this was a moment for our disabled audience as well and for us to really be with each other in the secrecy of knowing that this is what it is for us. So, yeah.
You didn't mention the going at enormous speed down high ramps.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
You have a thing about ramps.
I do. I mean, I think every wheelchair user does, and I'm certainly not the first to be able to articulate the actual raw pleasure of running down those ramps. And I mean, if you think about it for a moment, it's that moment of being on the top of a hill on a bike. or being at the top of a hill on a ski slope or a skateboard. This is a common moment of physical movement pleasure. Why are ramps designed in such a way that they're really emphasizing the functionality of getting in and out of a building, but not necessarily the pleasure of movement in and out of the building, not necessarily the pleasure of the architecture of the building? So I'm thinking about ramps as these kind of architectural spaces for movement pleasure.
Now, I pushed my father, who is a wheelchair user, down and up many, many ramps, and the issues of inclusion when I was coming up in the 60s and 70s were very grave. Interestingly, he performed on Broadway twice and got a lot of reviews over many, many years, most of which never mentioned he was in a wheelchair, which was, at that time, people's idea of being nice, not mentioning it.
Right.
We're in a very different period.
We are and we aren't. We are all over the map. There are some parts of our culture that are still struggling with what is the polite word to say and how do we mention it? Do we mention it? Do we look the other way? How do we even think about the image? Do you shoot the wheelchair? Do you photograph it? Some parts of the world are still wrestling with this. And other parts of the world are like, well, I'm here, I'm disabled, but it doesn't define me, and it's not who I am, and you can see me as a person. And there are other parts of the world, and this is the part that I'm most interested in, is that this is about the culture, the aesthetics, the politics, the social and political advocacy work. All of this work is embedded in one thing, where if you are not looking at the wheelchair and the wheelchair's movement as much in the same way as you're looking at my hands and my arms, you're missing half the work. Mm. So partly the world that I'm interested in is not about, do we have inclusion? We don't have full and equitable and just inclusion. But the conversation is branching around that now to think about what does it mean to have different kinds of equitable participation, equitable experience, which is more than the language of inclusion. And that's where I want to go in my art. Mm. It's not enough to be on stage. It's how we're on stage. It's the work we're in on stage. It's the roles that we're cast in. It's how we're represented in newspapers. It's not just like the one. It's the how and the why.
Mm-hmm. We'll come back to the roles again in a second. But are you alone in this? What's the context in which you're operating?
I am not. Fortunately, so this is a really important moment. I think media and representation tends to pick out one person and will name one person, but I'm not alone. I actually am part of a movement of people coming at this from film, from theater, from policy, from dance, and I'm also part of a legacy that goes back to the civil rights movement and that world that you were mentioning back in through the 60s to where we are now. So I'm here now, but as you go through all the materials, there's a movement of us.
So would you say it's fair to compare, there was a black arts movement, is there now a disability arts movement, aesthetic movement? Is that the right comparison?
I hope so. I mean, but here's the thing. I mean, I think labels get added retroactively or retrospectively. So I would say in some ways, there's a disability arts and disability culture manifesto coming out of the UK that is much, much earlier than we've seen articulations in American culture. But this is a new moment. And here in New York, this is a new moment. And we're really thinking about disability arts manifesting a lot through dance, but also in other, in visual arts. We're seeing theater, the National Disability Theater. We're seeing all kinds of people that are somehow in their own disciplines beginning to just flower in different ways. So I believe, you know, 10, 15 years from now, somebody will say, this is a renaissance of disability arts. But as we are in it right now, it is a movement. But unlike other arts movements, I don't want it to be over, right? Because you think of the arts movement, you name it, and it gets to this kind of swell and this peak, and then it stops. But I don't want the movement to peak and then go. I want it to be whew.
So two questions. One is, we talk a lot on the show about the sort of insidious normal, the normal economy, the normal cruelty, the normal patriarchal relations. What's the damage that you think ideas of the normal have done when it comes to art and our bodies and motion and movement and all the stuff you think about all the time?
Wow, the normal. I often say the normative because it gets us away from the notion of normal. And helps us realize that normal is constructed and that there actually is no normal, right?
Which is also true for all those other things.
Right,
keep going.
Right. So how is it that we have this notion of normal?
And what does it do to us?
And what does it do? And for me, I think it circumscribes what is understood as aesthetic movement, which circumscribes how people do or do and don't get the opportunities to be on stage. And it also circumscribes the recognition of work by disabled artists as art. For me, I could be in the space of constantly trying to undermine, or I could just set up again and start in this different space and ask the question, not how do I undo the normative, but what is here, what is present, what can we work in and around, what do we know, and then have that feed backwards.
You have challenges, though. I heard you talking about trying to work with motion capture technology.
It's been interesting.
For people that don't know motion capture, that's the kind that tries to line little dots up to represent your body and create almost like animated representations of people dancing or whatever.
Right. So we went through this kind of motion capture experience and had twice have been very different kinds of embodiments and have watched the data. You can capture the raw data, which is great, but it's the moment of what happens when you try and turn the data into a body. And that moment of transformation, the algorithms by which the bodies are recreated, turned out to be normative. And so the data, the algorithm tried to crunch the body back into the patterns that it knew. And instead of getting representations of me, it got this kind of crunch thing that was not me. And so it's normative patterning was actually remaking my body. And I'm like, that's not representation. That's actual erasure.
This is Laura Flanders. I'm Laura. My guest is artist, activist, and academic Alice Shepherd. She is the founder of Kinetic Light, an arts collective working at the intersections of disability, technology, and race. You can see Shepherd and Kinetic Light in action by watching this week's episode at our website. That's lauraflanders.org. And if you've yet to subscribe to our podcast, where you get all sorts of free extras, do it through your favorite podcast app. And if that app is Apple Podcasts, please take a moment to rate the show and write a review. It helps us spread the word. Later in the program, we're going to be heading to the Streb Lab for Action Mechanics, or SLAM, in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, where we'll meet the action architect and founder Elizabeth Streb and her crew. They defy gravity and make art. The conversation continues, meanwhile, with Alice Shepherd to share what a disability perspective can get for all of us. And can all of us get one?
When you see, do you find? When you look out through the window of your mind, when you stand at the door, tell me who it is you're waiting for.
And a lot of people talk about a disability perspective. Mm. What is it? How does it change things? And what things does it change? And can all of us get a disability perspective?
Oh, I wonder.
I wonder.
Okay. Who? No, I don't think you can. I don't think you can, because I think the disability perspective is something that is both a combination of how you take in the world, how you experience the world, and the research, the lived experience of being in the world, and the research and the knowledge and the interactions with traditions, so that filter through your body and mind out into your daily experiences. So you can structure a world that, from a disability perspective, you can, like for me, you might make the world only five and a bit feet high. You might think about where the placement of architecture and shelves, and you might create the physical space, but partly perspective is also about the way you interact with people in the space. And so I always joke that, like, on the streets, the first thing I see of you, if I'm looking down, is your shoes. Great, I know people by their shoes, but I also see an awful lot of bellies and butts, because that's what I see at that height. And so I think that the perspective is earned and developed over time, and it interacts with what we know and what we've read. From the outside world, you can get an understanding, but from the inside world, Yeah, it's from that internal knowledge, like lived experience.
You have a long list of things that you didn't want me to talk about.
Let's talk about the things we didn't want to talk about.
No, let's talk about why.
Okay.
Why is it not helpful to talk about a whole lot of things that people love to talk about when the word disability crops up?
All right. So almost every journalistic experience that you see, and you know, even if it's not the first paragraph in a newspaper article, it's in the second paragraph. You know, it's and it almost always begin every interview story is the narrative, like what is it the constant accounting of what happened to you, and sometimes nothing happens. Sometimes you know you were born with a disability, but the constant idea is that somehow disability has to be explained. You have to give your diagnosis, and then you have to explain how you arrived at this diagnosis and what the implications of this medicalization of disability is. And it sets disability up as a medical situation, something that is wrong, a deficit, and something that always has to be accounted for in this kind of personal narrated way, and never actually allows for an understanding of a disability as an embodied whole experience that just is. I often, when I'm asked that question about what happened to you, I will often reverse the question, like, what happened to you? or why do you want to know? What will you know?
What will you do with that? How will that help you talk about
Right. How will that help you talk about my work? Well, it doesn't. How will that help you talk about whatever situation we're in right now? If I'm at the post office and you want to know what happened to me.
Let's go back to that representation question. Yeah. Judy Heumann recently wrote a report looking at media representations of people with disabilities, of disabled people, pick your language. And she came up, surprise, surprise, this population are having the treatment that comes to so many marginalized groups, which is they get to be villains or victims. At the same time, she said that the Brits are doing things a little bit better, the British.
Yeah.
You and I share something to do with the British. Are they doing it better? And if so, what are they doing better or different?
Because the government, because of the social systems, were able to think about funding and supporting individual artists, somehow the world shifted. People were exposed in a way to the art, to the work, to the and one by one, and it was sadly one by one, programs popped up, podcasts popped up, disabled actors popped up, independent artists were funded, there were performances, there was funded for groups. And so by these seed fundings in all of these places, you could begin to mesh together a culture of disability. Not the same culture by any means, but maybe I should say cultures of disability. And that gave space for different languages about disability. And you know, I'm not going to say the UK, not that we're doing it right, because, of course, there are many ways in which things are awful. But I will say that the language and the kind of casual representation, I mean, I remember once there was a Channel 4 ident of a wheelchair user, radical, just like a couple of seconds. Somehow, by thinking about how to get people into the space and the terms on which they wanted to be included. So both are important, not just the representation of one, but the terms by which somebody wants to be represented and the art that they make there, change the culture of expectation around disability. There's a growing awareness that disability is more than a circumstance of the body and that it can and does positively contribute to art.
Intersectionality, disability,
yes.
Diversity. My goodness. In New York, they recently opened this public art thing called the Vessel, which looks to me as sort of like a temple to stairs. And it's almost made worse every time everyone says to me, yes, but there's an elevator.
The elevator takes you to the top, but the experience of the artwork is stairs. Why would you construct a public work of art that is massively and culturally inaccessible?
It does reflect the drawbacks to the ADA, though, because if it's just about can you get to the top...
This is the problem with inclusionary and compliance-rated thinking, right? Inclusionary thinking, compliance kind of thinking, is the elevator that will get you to the top. Participatory, cultural, and aesthetic thinking is about what is the experience of being in the art itself.
You touched on it earlier, but we often ask our guests, what's the story you would like the future to tell about this moment? What's yours?
That in 2019, after many, many 50 to 60 years of work, the disability arts movement exploded across the United States, across the world, that there was a rising wave, and suddenly the wave just kept going, and that disabled artists and culture makers were recognized.
From your lips.
To the world.
Alice Shepard is performing all across the country, Atlanta, San Francisco, elsewhere this year. You can find more information at our website. What if somewhere on your block let you move as you dream of moving and taught you even how to fly? That's the lucky situation of people who live near SLAM, the Streb Lab for Action Mechanics in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. SLAM is the home base of action architect Elizabeth Streb, who believes everyone can fly in their fashion. The pursuit of flight changes people. It can also change a neighborhood. I should say I'm pretty damn fond of Streb and SLAM. Elizabeth is my partner of many years. For those who don't know her, I'm happy to introduce you.
SLAM's a lot of things. That's for starters.
I would say Streb is an intense expression of the soul.
The way I would describe Streb is, it's like family.
What is this place, Reggie? The best place ever. I come here when I'm like stressed out and I just want to get away from everything. This is where I would come.
They do dramatic performances, something I've never seen before in my life.
They do all types of stuff. You would think you're watching a movie or something. Like it's like an action movie. Everything is action.
SLAM is a vestibule initially for the invention of extreme action.
Elizabeth Streb, founder, Streb Lab for Action Mechanics, or SLAM.
And also the invention of hardware. Because without hardware or without instruments for action, you can't really get off the ground and actually enter space, actually enter a new temporal universe, and go faster, harder, higher, sooner. It's also a place where everybody is invited into it.
The art is the epicenter of this building.
Zaire Baptiste, collaborator.
So when we all walk in, we're walking in because of the art. The art is what employs everybody. The art is what stirs the mind of everyone. The art is what draws the children in. So the art is the epicenter. And from that art, we all find our place.
If a person wandered in here, had no idea who we were, they would walk in and possibly see people hanging with silks or hoops or swinging on the flying trapeze and doing flips or getting caught or just swinging and doing knee hangs, watching the Streb Extreme Action Company experiment with different pieces of equipment. There's a plexiglass wall over there that we hook up and make rigid, and they'll see people slamming into it with enormous amounts of force. Or they'll see a kids' action class. They'll see these frolicky, beautiful children doing a move, inventing some actions, flying.
I am future company. I am definitely going to be in the company.
Reggie Jackson, student.
I love it here. I feel at home. I never want to leave. And the people here, the teachers that teach me, I'm in Kid Advanced, they are awesome. They are the most amazing people. They are understanding, and they teach us really, really well. And I always feel like I can talk to them, and it's awesome. It's the best.
I learned about Streb at the job fair for SYAP's internship.
Gabby Cirillo, trapeze staff.
I told my friend when I saw SLAM, I was like, I'm going to work there. I'm going to work there for a long time. Mark my words. And we still laugh about it to this day. I walked in the first morning. It was a whole group of us. We were just so amazed with the space in total and the energy around it. And then I started helping out with the trapeze that same exact day. I've gone through a long journey with the flying trapeze, starting from interning throughout the year. And now I actually teach.
I believe humans can fly. And a big part of that was this beautiful epiphany I had many years ago, that if you're gonna fly and you're not an insect, you gotta land. Landing is, in a certain way, way more important than flying. Flying is beautiful and gorgeous, but our whammo, like, you know, 170-pound body just hitting flat, bluntly onto the ground, shakes a building. And it's just a profound activity to be willing to do that.
You know, when we're bounded in action and in passion and in, you know, wild, crazy dreams.
Cassandra Joseph, Associate Artistic Director, STREB.
The community is reinforced, and I think it's stronger. Our bonds are stronger. I think, you know, we care so much about not just the person, but having them actualize their dreams. And I find that, you know, that we don't really have that often in the society. I think we're very, you know, into keeping order, you know, and making sure that kids know how to follow the rules. And so this is a breath of fresh air, you know, and it's a breath of fresh air for everyone because, you know, it's contagious.
The metric for success at SLAM, which got developed over the 15 years, is really the notion of the invention, inventing extreme action. What is a move no one's ever done before? What's a piece of hardware or an instrument of action that can get you to higher places, altitudes? And I think that this place has also developed a technical laboratory for usually young men, but young women too, to figure out how to have theatrical skills, to be able to hang people, to be able to hang equipment, to be able to move it.
The most important value at SLAM is not just performances, but the performance, the safety of the performance people.
Jelani Lewis, a member of the STREB technical crew.
A skill set that I've learned is basically like carpentry and building, not only plywood and, you know, wood, but truss and metal objects. I've learned that when you do rigging and stuff, you have to make sure that it's strong and sturdy, and you have to use the proper equipment, because if you use the incorrect equipment, then it could, you know, damage somebody.
Coming to work at a dance company was kind of different, you know. I wasn't expecting what I was presented with.
Joseph Jackson, technical crew member.
It gave me a different perspective of just looking at dancers differently now, like just seeing what they go through, how they, you know, they gotta work every day to get to that, you know, that perfection, you know. I see them different now.
What exists right here is something that should be replicated elsewhere.
Zaire Baptiste, collaborator.
Because what it is it allows different people to enter a room and drop everything that they came in there with. And I think in this room is the example for humanity. It's how humanity should be set up. We don't go in prejudging each other. We don't go in taking each other down. We go in to uplift each other at all times. And that's something that once you leave out of these doors, you might not find until you re-enter.
My big dream is to have a demonstration of a STREB extreme action to hit the world the same way that NASCAR did and monster trucks did and rodeos and westerns and rock and roll. I want that. I want that kind of action to be permeated into society and, you know, rip the stain of art off of us. Every single thing we do is public, because guess what? The public pays for it on some level or another. I mean, yes, Lincoln Center is public, but it's not the same kind of public that we're manifesting here at SLAM. At SLAM, I wanted to know that anyone who walked by this garage door immediately just felt welcome to walk in. And how do you figure out how to construct that energy where the person gets curious and somehow, for some reason, they walk in?
You too can learn how to fly, flip, and fall at the STREB Lab for Action Mechanics in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. You can find out more information and a link at our website. That's lauraflanders.org. That's also where you can watch this week's show, and it is really one worth watching. See our guests in action, including STREB and her crew, and esteemed choreographer Alice Shepherd in her wheelchair. For additional research material and information on all of my guests, go to patreon.com/theLF show. That is patreon.com/theLF show. You don't have to be a contributor, but do consider signing up. We are in the midst of a May Day to Memorial Day membership drive, and we've just started, and we're doing great guns. Think of committing just $3, $5, or $12 a month. It's kind of like dropping just loose change in a virtual hat every time you listen to the program. Members receive a bunch of audio exclusives, including uncut long-form interviews, research packets, and music in the middle our podcast featuring a little discussion between me and Jeannie Hopper, our podcast producer, about the music on the program. We may be independent, but we are dependent on you. Your support helps us remain ad-free, and your donation is tax-deductible to the extent allowed by law. Thank you so much, and check out the video. Really, I mean it. LauraFlanders.org, and thanks. This show is produced by yours truly, Laura Flanders, with Monica Mohapatra, Charlotte Carpenter, Nat Needham, Natasha Gaspar, Jeannie Hopper, Joanna Pinto, and Dominic Marcella. The Laura Flanders Show is made possible from the Novo, Ford, Tomcat, Cloud Mountain, and Fonda Foundations, as well as by listeners like you. So thank you. Stay kind, stay curious. Until the next time, I'm Laura.